Simona will introduce you a little bit more about what the initiative is about and how come that we are trying also to tackle with the question of the borders, borderless borders between arts and healing and care, which are our, let's say, the concepts around which we, and ethics, the concepts that we are working with within the very loose collective since more than 4 years now. But first and foremost, it's kind of ongoing collective practice, actually, that involves artists, curators, activists, therapists, lawyers, who are devoting their, basically their entire lives sometimes to questions of the methods of working that are based on ethics, that are based on care, non-toxicity, non-violence, and mutuality. So we are, in a way, working around those issues. And I'm specifically very moved today because collective is also a collective based on friendship. And friendship in contemporary art is a very contested word. Those that know contemporary art practices well, you know that friendships are delicate, very delicate zones of living and being, and that can be overshadowed in contemporary art very quickly by all kinds of interests and all kinds of attempts and expectations. So I'm very proud to say that our collective tries to work around the concept of friendship as a political concept. And so there is also friendship here. There is a history of long friendship here tonight with the presence of Eid Sandberson that I have known since a very, very long time. And that I'm very, very moved to have you here tonight with us. Together with, who is an artist, I mean, Simona, you will a little bit explain, but I'm just giving you a little bit of the table set. Together with Eid's mom, Augusta Altdottir, who is going to present her work around Sigridor Björnsdottir. So you will hear a little bit about that throughout the evening. Simona, who is a curator at the initiative. We would like to thank Megan for all the organizational skills and smoothness in our communication and collaboration. Thank you so much. And Tamara Singh, who is also with us actually since the beginning of this joint venture, who is an art therapist, artist, working on boundaries between, not boundaries, but intersections between creative practices, healing, horticulture, plants, objects, conversations, sounds.
Augusta is an artist, and she has been formed in the sociology, and she was written this book also. That was coming from the experience that you also had with the art therapy, and I think also it's very important moment to gather all of this, what you also learn about her work and also about this this relation that you have together in this book, because there is also a lot of testimony from the different art therapy sessions that were with the children, but also with the adults. And there is also a lot of archival materials, so it's absolutely beautiful book. And also Egil Sebjornsson, who is also contributed to this book, because you coordinated the book. You are also a visual artist and a musician, I have to say. And you are also some of our system. This is also very important to say. And you also have one interview in the book, which I really enjoy to read with Sigridur, and it's about you are questioning actually her art practice also, which is a very specific approach because it's going a lot beyond the traditional perception of the art as a kind of aesthetic object or fixed object or a final product. But it's a lot about what art can be also, you know, all of that. So I think that we will also speak a little bit about it later. And so as the, so it was already a little bit introduced, Tamara Singh, who is here with us and who is also a member of the Initiative for Practices and Visions of Radical Care. And Tamara, you are a health professional, horticultural therapist, and art therapist. And you are using mainly writing and visual arts as a method of therapy. So you will also speak a little bit about it. And but you are also artist, poet, musician, and a cello player. And so we will also get a little bit back to the sound composition that we were listening in the entrance. I think that we will start by watching the video of the exhibition that Abu started together with Egil, Mom's Pool. So I will ask you, Egil, to put the play, and after that I will let you to introduce a little bit what we saw. Would you like to say a couple of words about to add about this this project, and maybe also Augusta, you would like to tell about the objects that you brought and about your practice.
Yes. Thank you. Nice to see you all here. I'm glad. Okay. I was not in arts. For many years, I was a teacher in college. I taught sociology, so I had a university education, and I didn't see myself as in the art. But then I started art therapy with Sigur, and it made me feel so good that after I had been 3 years in art therapy sessions with her once a week. But not during the summer. I started full-time study in visual art. So I stopped teaching sociology, and I have not been teaching since then. I just turned to the visual art. So this you can see example of it. When I started art therapy sessions with Sigríður, I really was a bit arrogant. I thought I had no need for any psychological help or something because I had been studying at university and I had had different experience as a child. My mother was very seriously depressed, so I thought I knew so much about life that I didn't have to do any help, you know. But I started just for fun, just to see how it was. And I kept on because I felt so good when I was in this therapeutic sessions with Sigríður, and she helped me a lot. But yeah, it was very invisible how I started to feel better, how I was more happy. And so I came very curious to understand how art therapy helped me so much. Is it possible for me to write a small booklet about your teaching? Because I always wanted to teach the conversation, the sociology, but I didn't succeed because I didn't know the method, you know. So I was also frustrated when I was a teacher in that way. And she said yes, so I started to talk to her about her technique. And as I was not teaching, I just kept on, and it became this book, this small booklet about teaching. As I said, it was very invisible how my emotional life became better, and I was more happy. And as a child, I was very angry. And once, when I talked to Sigríður in one session about rage, she said, well, some people say if you forget, you get loose of the anger. But I said, I will never forget. It's not a way for me to do. But it's incredible that my rage disappeared in art therapy, but in quite an invisible way. I didn't understand how. But I do it now, and now I understand. And now I have written a whole book about my problem. I have to say, I didn't write about the method, I just let her voice come here, how she describes it herself, and I use examples from her therapy. So, and she's a complete pioneer. When she graduated from art school in Reykjavik in 1952, she had a very strong mission. She wanted to present art to sick and disabled children. And she went straight ahead to make that vision come true. She went to London in the summer 1952 when she graduated and was an intern at the very famous children's hospital in London. And there she was allowed to teach the children after her own method. She was starting to develop, and she said, well, I saw the teachers there were good in the hospital school. They were good, they had good material, they had a lot of teaching technique. But the children were unhappy and they were sad. So I started to allow them to express themselves in their drawing and to express them and to express their feelings. And they started to talk. They started to talk and they started to be seemingly happy, you know. So I kept on developing this method. And she was two summers and 1 year as an intern in London. And she worked for a year at the Maudsley Mental Hospital, which is very famous in London. Yes, she said they were very sick children, very mental sick, and I learned very much this year. And I will tell you one story here that's in the book. She had a boy that was 10 years old that came to the hospital, and he was diagnosed schizophrenic. He was 12 years old, and he had not told to anybody since he was 4. He stopped talking when he was 4 years old. And the doctor said he was schizophrenic, and he started art therapy with Sigga, although she was intern. She was allowed to work her methods at this hospital, at the psychiatric department. And after the boy came to her first, he didn't touch anything, he didn't say a word. He was completely apathetic. And she took him every day in a session, and after some weeks he started to look at the poster paints and do something, and then it kept on for four more months. He came to her every day, and he started after five months he was sad. He was not schizophrenic. He was very damaged emotionally. He learned to express himself through his pictures and also to talk about his feelings. So, like Sigga said, she always wanted to give the children opportunities. She just gave them the material, she sat with them and showed interest in what they were doing. And she said that everybody is able to express themselves in art. And the art is in every person here inside. You are born with it inside you. So, and she said also that in the creative process, when you are making the picture, the healing goes on. Then the healing is going on in the process. So it was very important that they got this opportunity that is, you know, they were given everything and trust and interest from her, and she listened to what they said about the future. And then every child, whatever sick they were, every child did something. They all expressed themselves. So they had this power inside. Well, what's more happening? It's just the main point in this book. Like this, there are several examples, you know, and also pictures. This boy says, I think I'm going, I'm so afraid I will die. I'm so afraid of the needles. And there's so many children in hospital that are like that. And then he gets opportunity to tell. Most of them have to keep quiet, not to express their afraid. So that's important. Okay, I think I have support.
I just wanted to say that I was also so impressed also when I was reading the book about how she's working this way, building this trust, which was so much about the listening and also to just the giving the space and time also, and to create a relation, to create this trust. So this is very important, and also to have the space of touching the things around us, these organic materials and everything, that was also very important part of her practice. And so I wanted to ask Egil, because you also spoke a lot about this notion of play in the video, and this is also something that was also very important part practice of Sigilur. So would you like to introduce a little bit also this notion, what has it been for you also, and what was how the experience with art therapy also influenced your practice? And maybe then you can tell us a little bit about this interview that you made with Sigurdur, so to just tell about what you were discussing.
Yes, of course. So I was helping my mother to organize all the papers and bringing it to publishers and stuff like that, so I spent quite some time with material, and actually I did go to art therapy also to Sigrid when I was 16 years old, and again when I was 21, so I have known her kind of the biggest part of my life. And when I helping my mother to put the book together, I also realized that how much of a kind of a, how special her work has been inside of art, and that it was so special that she was working with these children to make progress with, like my mother says, like Sylvia says, exploring something on the inside and expressing it in a picture. And I find a lot of resonance in like with how you were talking about your work with people, and I was so I talked about it a lot with Sylvia as well for these years that we were putting this book together, I think that somehow what she was doing, because the 2020th. So I maybe explain a little bit what that interview was about. So as we know, the 20th century was so much about discovering, like, what can art be? You know, can you take a pissoir and turn it upside down and write something on it and say that is art? Or for some time, people were not sure if photography was really art or just photographs, or if film and video is art or performance, and like all these formats of painting becoming an installation and all of that stuff. But in somehow, some way, she found also like a crack in the wall of what art can be, because the works that these children are making, they're maybe not masterpieces of art that will be hung up at the Pompidou or the Louvre or something. They are not maybe important for the kind of the art world and the market, the capitalistic market, and kind of the world of specialists of art that talk about art, which is also great. But these artworks that the people are doing, and her practice is about like the works that these children were making didn't matter maybe for the art world, but they could mean everything for them. And that is so amazing, to be working inside the space of art, where the artworks can mean everything for the person. And this aspect of art is, must be so huge. And so she had some sort of a vision about this coming from her childhood. She grew up partly on a farm also, and she was left alone outside, and so she was playing out in nature, and sometime when somebody called her name to come in or something like that, then they asked, she's called Sika, so she said, like, which Sika? The Sika in the mud, or the Sika in the sticks, or the Sika in the grass? Because she had like this relationship with that, and somehow when she got her diploma from art school, to be an artist but also to be a teacher, she understood, like, she says that she got like this image in her head, that she held the paper in her hand and she said that, I knew that I cannot teach children anything about art. They have it inside of themselves. So when she went to London to learn what they were doing there in the hospitals, she started to, instead of showing the children how to make art, she understood that she just put paper in front of them and put colors and things to draw with, and just be with them. So that they, and then they started to do things themselves. And the children started then to talk about the picture. She would never interpret what they were doing. And that's the process that my mother was describing. And I think I felt also a lot that Tamara is doing, although you will tell much more about what you think later in her practice. And that is a beautiful space within art. And I think that, so I think that Sigrid and other people that were developing these approaches around the same time around the world, that she then later became also friends with, like Edith Kramer, that, you know, they were not only pioneers in art therapy, because art therapy is often seen as something coming from the medicinal world, but they are kind of pioneers in finding this other space within art, the healing aspect of it. And I see now more and more artists in our times that are working with art as kind of a healing tool. And I think that that was not understood at that time from the artistic professional society, that what she was doing and these people were doing was also really art. But it's like so often, like this famous story of Marcel Duchamp that did things in the 1910s and 20s, and he was, and other people were only able to explain it in the 1960s, sometimes the world just has to evolve a little bit. And now there are so many artists that are working with the healing aspect of art, so it's interesting to look at Sigrid's work in that light. And that's what I was trying to talk about in this interview and asking her. And, yeah.
Art heal. There are many, many theories about that. And they go from the very excessive ones that are based in neurosciences, now that we can study the brain and what's going on in the brain when we do art, and talking about the plasticity of the brain and making new connections. There's a school of art therapists that's very much based in neurological sciences. And then there's, on the other spectrum, you have the artists who are more interested in what art allows people to do, which is, I think I fall more on that side because I'm also a practitioner of the arts. I think that art therapy allows people to work on what they say in French, les parties saines. So instead of focusing on what's wrong, we focus on what's right, what you can do, not what you can't do. So can you have fun? Can you explore? Can you ask questions? Can you try something new? Can you show something new? Can you all the things you can do? As an art therapist, I work. My approach is very much based in my first work with nature, because I'm also a horticultural therapist, and I worked a lot on nature in quotations because it's also a vast subject. Natural items, growing beings. So I'm a weaver, and I work a lot with willow and rushes and things like this. So this is some of my first work. And I would make, and then sometimes I would go to the schools and I would teach and ask the children to help, and we would collaborate. And so there are a few of these living structures in schools in London, for example. And they're still growing. It's a temporal process. I was also working a lot in installations. This is a very old slide, so I'm just going to go through some of the things. Weaving, this is a beehive that I made. So my practices are very much in volume, some of them. And then I started working with children in the hospitals around growing. This is in New York. In a city that's very urban, where the children have nearly no access to soil or planting. But it was about playing. What happens when you play? When you touch, when you smell, when you even taste. So when you speak about learning, it's like an invisible, something invisible is happening. Some of it is, again, allowing the person to work with what they can do instead of saying, focusing on what's wrong or what's broken. This is again in the hospitals, and then working with clay. Again, the thing with working with patients is always trying to find or help them discover the media that makes most sense for them. So in my practice, I have many, many media at their disposition, because I'm also a multimedia practitioner. I work with natural items, I work with clay, I work with images, I work with sound, I write, and so everyone's going to have their own preference, and it's important to respect that. It's like putting a page in front of someone and saying, okay, have a go. If you don't like that, oh, look over there, there's something else you can discover. And in my office, everyone can touch everything. There's nothing that's hands-off. Nothing. And this is important in a country like France, where they always tell the children, for example, touch with your eyes, not with your hands. It's an expression. It's a terrible expression. It means that you can't get close to something and see what happens in a relationship. So for me, the invisible thing is about creating a relationship with the materials, which is maybe also symbolic for how you create relationship with yourself and with other people. Let's see. Here. Okay, this is in the hospital where I was told I could not bring anything. This is in France, a French hospital. I was told I couldn't bring any organic material. I couldn't bring anything. I said, okay, so when we'll just work with images and work with the imagination and storytelling. Instead of focusing on what's wrong, the pain, the incapacity, the disability, but what can we still do? We can imagine. We can tell stories. So this is what I was doing in the hospital. So this is some more of my work. I alternate some of my work, some professional work. This is some images I was making. I was interested in creating soil. This is some work outdoors. So I also find it interesting to work with things that don't remain, where you only have a picture, to see what happens when people are not focused on a product. Something that will disappear, that will stay, and it will stay the time that it stays, and the wind will blow these pieces away. I also have other types of activities as a very kind of social, political activities where I do some humanitarian missions, or I'm working with people who are the farthest away from persons who can have access to mental health care. So that would be people from the queer community, people who are trans or transitioning, and that's why it's very interesting to work with, to allow them to see, they're already creating with their bodies, making change, but to work with media can be also very liberating, so that they can transfer some of the anxiety around some of the things that they're working on in their own bodies. I have some images of work of the people I would come to see, but I will not show them here because I did not preliminarily make a confidentiality agreement with you. So this is my space. So there are lots of things to touch and play with and examine and try and pick up. And then my other practices as an artist, I mostly work now with music and word. Because it made sense to me to start to do that versus working with volumes. It was also a way of protecting myself in the sense that all of the people who come to see me work with objects and volumes. And I needed to create more distance between myself and the people who come to see me. So I started working more in other media. So that's kind of a... small presentation. I find this a question of healing and the invisible processes. It's even we don't quite know how it works. And for everyone it's going to be different. Some people will think, okay, as I said, the neurologists, there are people who think that it's a complete mystery. There are others who think that it's just the preparation to healing, meaning that you're allowing someone to learn to build trust. Like, what is it like to create the presence of someone? What is it like to be in the same space with someone, week after week? What is it like to explore and to get it wrong, get it wrong, and then try again? And all of that in a space that you have decided is safe enough for you to do that. So there are so many different dynamics at play that there's no fixed one. It's always very different depending on the individual person, because we are dealing with singularities. Everyone is a singular individual with their own story. And so they're going to come to the materials in a very individual way. So it's difficult to make like a general theory of how it works. I think we have to remain humble. Say for each individual it's going to work in a very singular way. Yeah. And what we can do best as therapists is provide the spaces that you were saying.
I wanted to say that it gives me always hope, like when you are talking about your practice, because and to know about the work of Sigrid, and because I mean I studied art and I've been an artist since 1997, and I think I was in many ways doing kind of typical art, you know, that some installations and things you exhibit in normal places of exhibiting art, and but somehow, when I was doing the Trolls, for example, it's based on the play that I had with my brother since we were children. And I was doing that also in art school, but didn't really see it as kind of serious art. You know, you're an art student and you want to do something that people take seriously. But then I did actually quite a few works with this kind of like invented characters, and in some of the images that were there were two trolls, And they are my imaginary friends, and it's kind of a continuation of the play with my brother that has been going on since we were teenagers and kids. And I find that in the conversation with my brother, when we are bullshitting inside of our world of the characters that we have made, it's so liberating, you know, and it's this kind of play, and we do all kinds of stupid things that only those characters do, and you are not kind of allowing yourself to do in normal life, and it's very liberating for me. So that's why I decided to bring, for example, do this work with my two trolls. So yeah, for example, when I went to do the Venice Biennial, the Icelandic Pavilion in 2017, was for the first time that I showed trolls. And I really did not really know what I was doing, but I was just going with the intuition that it was fun to play. And I found that very important. And I remember using the words of something like the creative power that exists before art. It's kind of like, it's in the play, it's in exactly trying and not succeeding, but then maybe trying again and succeeding. And it's kind of like, I felt it was something that is in humans that is just so important, the playfulness. And that kind of almost exists as something that existed before art became also this kind of more serious thing. It's kind of like a primordial element or something that is very human. And yeah. And also how you were working with the nature and soil and all of that, I find very fascinating.
I like that you come back to this idea of play, and when we had the first meeting we talked a little bit about it, and one of my theoretical fathers is Donald Winnicott, who insisted on play as a necessary element in development and in how a subject is born, or how a subject can maintain itself through play. And so maybe people forget how to play. And so some of my work is literally teaching people to play again, or giving, not teaching them, but allowing them to have the space to know that they can play. And this is what's interesting about things like working with soil or plants or outside, is that suddenly maybe people may feel there's subtypes. It depends on the person. They're not taking the types of risks they're taking, or how dangerous it is. Sometimes it can be easier if they know, oh, there's a lot of soil. I can try many different things. Or it's okay if something doesn't work out. Well, I can go and get some more. You know, and get some more leaves. There are tons of leaves. Yeah. Right. Yeah. So depending on what media is available, or who is the person you're working with, because those people are terrified of the woods for various reasons, trying to turn on that mechanic of play is almost like the part of the objective in and of itself. Just getting people to be.
Yeah, but I actually wanted to ask you something because speaking also about this playfulness and also about this self-confidence and also self-expression, I also found interesting, I think it was when we are discussing all together also, we spoke about the fact that there is also this limited space of self-expression for most of the people also who are not artists, you can say maybe like that. And we were speaking also about how, for example, the activities as reparation of the clothes, for example, or some household activities can be also this way how one can express some feelings or so, or the emotions, the space of this self-expression, this which is also very playful way, this reparation also. And so I wanted to ask you if you can tell us a little bit about also these objects that you brought and how you work with them.
I make a balls out of canvas. No, And this is from close, from my family, you know? Because it's a kind of influence from my mother, who was a weaver, and she used to weave for the home, you know? But I can't weave, so I use the clothes by making balls of it, like you saw. Maybe an artist, a big ones. So that's my way to reuse things, and I get a lot of I feel very good when I'm reusing things, you know, because everybody is talking about the environment, as you know, and we have to be more careful about the earth. So I'm very much there and fighting for that in many, many fields. And also I make boxes that come to my home. I use them to draw on them, both because it's environmental and also because I like it's so soft material. They are so nice to draw on. My focus is a bit, I get some, I'm not as frustrated about the environment if I can do something like using things that I would throw away. So, yeah. You, did that answer?
Okay. Can I add to the drawings? Yeah. I think that my mother has been, if I may something add to it, she's been working a lot with the relationship with her mother, I think, is that, that's correct? And both through the art therapy and the stories here are, you see in the books and on these boxes are stories. So my mom then went walking with your mother every day almost for 20 years or something. And then they would sit down and have coffee, and there would all kinds of stories come about, serious and not serious, and important and not important. And my mother, you would then go home often and write them down in secret without telling your mom about it. And I remember that those books started to pile up, and I don't know, there must be many books. And I remember I was not allowed to tell anyone that you were writing those stories down.
That's right.
Because otherwise my grandmother would stop telling you stories.
I'll tell you some reason for it, because my mother was very careful not to tell me the names of the people she was telling me the stories, because she didn't want to tell stories from people. She was just telling me, you know. So it was a kind of. But I can also say that because she had very difficult depression when I was young, so our relationship became damaged, you know. And we started to work after I started art therapy. First at that time, I was able to do it because our relationship was damaged. The art therapy helped me to start again, you know, and we built it up. It was very good.
Just a little bit more about it was actually Karen Wright, who was in the movie before, who is an American woman that was the founder and editor-in-chief of Modern Painters, that it was an arts magazine that ran for a few decades. She saw some of my mom's work by coincidence, and then...
She saw this?
Yeah, exactly. And the title of the show that you saw the pictures of, which is called Mom's Balls, which she would always write as the subject in the emails, and she would always write joke alert, mom's balls, and she would write every time she told a joke in an email, she would put in joke alert and then put something, because mom's balls is actually the balls of these artworks, and then to have balls means to have courage. And she said that women especially, and well, also many people that don't see themselves as female, they did maybe not have so many opportunities to express themselves in a rather narrow, rigid society. So those, you see there the shopping bag of my grandmother that she made out of the ribbons from Christmas presents. And I remember as a child going to the store to shop with her, and she would always use this instead of plastic bags back in the 70s and the 80s. And beside it you see her indoor shoes. You can maybe lift one, and this is made from old stockings. So she recycled everything, which was not called, as we all know, it wasn't when our grandmothers were recycling, it was just using the material. It was normal back in the days. And so I think you are maybe somehow also referring to that.
Sure.
By your recycling. I remember when you were in art school, or we were in art school because we ended up at the same time in art school. You were doing, you were putting your pictures using like aluminium plates from food as a frame with a plastic over it, glass, and I found it very strange. But then I thought it was really cool 20 years later, because it was mega recycling art, you know. And but that was like totally influenced from your mother, because she used everything.
Yeah.
So yeah, just a few more angles like that. But yeah, you can see these things from my mother here. And now we are maybe going to try to make a book with some of your stories.
Maybe.
Maybe there are some questions already. Someone wants to comment. Natasha, maybe.
No, I just wanted to say maybe two things.
It would be wonderful to hear, because we didn't mention that Siga is still alive today, and she's 95 years old. So we didn't mention that, but we said before that working in that way makes you live long, obviously. So that was one thing. Maybe you want to say how you actually, if she has seen the book, how did you contribute to the book herself? That would be great to hear. And the second question was for Tamara to tell us a little bit about the genesis of the sound piece that is downstairs.
Yeah, I can about Sika and her contribution to the book. She gave me a lot of sources, of course. I could have all sources I wanted from her, written sources and like letters from all the pediatricians she worked with. She traveled all around the world, and many very famous and active pediatricians like to invite her to exhibit and tell about her work with the children. And she was always with me writing this, and she read over always occasionally. She was very, very good. She took so much part in it. She was very supportive. It was very, very interesting to work with her. I kept on learning after my art therapy, just working with
her. I just add one sentence that was such an important element, like my mom was saying earlier, that she was trying to let Sigrid tell her story herself, and was just kind of serving to bring out her own message. Oh, you want to ask about this book?
Yeah, because you also brought the book.
Yeah, so here you see a book, Dieter Roth in My Life, Memories, and this is them dancing in Iceland in the 50s. She had been writing her book about her life with Dieter Roth, but she was very shy in doing something about it, and then we encouraged her to just get it translated into English and helped her to get it published. So now there's that's about that. It's a good reading also.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Yeah. More about their personal lives.
I just wanted to mention, I find it interesting that you went from the art therapy to art school.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's something that when I work in hospitals, you see people who have been coming for many, many, many years, and it's happened on many occasions where it's almost as if the widening of the perspectives through making the art has helped to mend something, mend like architects are men, and they go towards the arts as wow. professional artists. Mm-hmm. I've had it to see it happen many okay. times. Yeah. And just about book, I find it interesting that it was able to be published once it was translated, like that she was more accepting of it because it was in English, like there's a distance, is that correct?
Yeah, well, this book, we first tried to bring it out in Iceland, but we didn't, people were not connecting with it. And so we kind of had to bring it outside of Iceland and ended up publishing it with...
It didn't work in Iceland.
I went to five publishers.
Yeah, I went to five publishers in Iceland and they didn't see it as something they wanted. It was worth publishing or something.
Well, I can tell. One of them said, I think it is for a bigger market. Mm. Well, that's also really fair to say that, at least.
Maybe they were right. So then we decided to get it translated, and we're thinking, where can we bring it out, and da-da-da-da-da. And then I got Hans Ulrich Obrist to do an interview with her, because he's been interviewing a lot of people, especially from this generation. And as she's kind of completely unknown within, because he also learned her practice wasn't in the classical art capitalistic markets. He was working in children hospitals, but making very important work in the name of art. So I introduced her to him, and he did, because I was working with him on another project, and I knew about all these interviews that he's doing. So Hans, why don't you take an interview with her? So he did an interview with her, and he actually helped us to connect also with König Books, which is a great publishing company in Germany, and they brought it out. Sika was, you know, because it's a book is very fragile about her personal life and her children. There are many children around, and well, we just encouraged her to try to bring it out somewhere else next, and then in the end we managed to get Hauser and Wirth Gallery, which is the gallery that presents Dieter Rose, to bring it out, and it would just bring it to a wider audience. So it was a process that happened, like in the end when we finished this book, we were just in the end.
Yeah,
we finished, but maybe in the printing or something, it was kind of almost parallel in the end.
I guess I was wondering if, just to come back to the art therapy, I was wondering if it was easier psychologically, emotionally, to publish, for her to accept the book to be published because it was published not in her native language. A little bit like when I work with some clients who are paraplegics, who are musicians, it's better for me to work with them using another media, like clay. Otherwise, there are too many defenses. So I was wondering if the using another language was like using another media.
I think that she would have to answer it herself, yeah. Obviously. She seemed quite confident to do it in Icelandic, but I don't know, it ended like that.
When we were working this one, we often discussed it was maybe clever to publish it in English because she worked so much in English. She was lecturing all around in English. She wrote in the magazines, her lectures came there in English, and we discussed it often, and and so it became.
Yeah, but I understand your question, but I can't answer it.
So So the sound piece, sorry, yes, the sound piece downstairs is the work of four musicians. I'm one of the composers, and it is actually a piece of music based on a short film that I made a few years ago, and I showed it in Berlin, and a musician was there, and they decided they wanted, they asked if they could make, if we could make some music around the short film. And the short film is a visual poem. It's a poem to and about a special kind of seed that has almost disappeared. It's a rice seed that grows in Western Africa that is a lot more hardy, that is a lot more resistant than the rice seed that comes from Asia and which has almost supplanted the West African seed. And so I initially made the short for the seed bank in Norway, in Svalbard, I think it's called. There's a seed bank that has all the seeds for, you know, if we have a doomsday apocalypse, and they have one. And they have some of this seed in the bank, and so I made the short film for, and the poem for the seed bank. And I told the story of how this West African, in the poem, I tell the story of how this West African seed was planted, not planted, almost planted, but braided into the hair of the young women who were sent across the ocean as slaves. And so you can find this rice variety, the seed variety, in certain parts of the Americas after this long journey across the Atlantic because the people planted it. So the music piece is inspired by this short film, and I worked with an Egyptian poet, a musician who's working with the water harp, and a saxophonist. So that's the piece used here downstairs. All of the musicians are from the minimalist vernacular, and we're still working on it, it's a work in progress. So horticultural therapy is another type of mediated therapy. Mediated meaning there's an intermediary, meaning that the relationship is not a binom, just the therapist and the patient, but like a trinom. So there's the patient and the therapist and this third element. And this third element is the living world, or whatever can remind you of the living organic world.
More questions?
Unfortunately, this profession doesn't exist in France.
It's
you can find it in the United States and in Canada and in Northern Europe, but it's not really recognized in France. People do. You have doctors in hospitals who have gardens, and you have some projects that are starting. And I was one of the co-founders of the federation that is trying to promote this mediation in France, but it's a lot of hard work.
If I understand correctly, France Fanon was also working with the gardens.
Yes.
There was a beautiful project by Mohamed Bourouissa, who is an artist living in France, who actually revisited with one of the Fanon's patients. The way he was working with the garden and horticulturally, it's beautiful videos that exist about it. And what was I about to ask?
Doesn't exist in France.
Doesn't exist in France. Thank you. This is really, we have telepathy going on. When we said, like, maybe we should speak a little bit about the objects, Simona was asking about objects, so it's beautiful. Thank you. Now, thank you for this. I was just wanting to, maybe it's a question for all, because we heard about a lot of attention given to the children who had in hospitals no means to express themselves. And it brings me to post-colonial critical Tamara, who has been part of a collective here in France called Psy Noir. And I wonder if you could explain us a little bit about this side of your practice as well, that had to do with people who we call racialized.
Yeah.
So this is the part where you really don't want to say anything outside. And so I'm going to specifically ask you for your confidentiality because of the political situation in France today. And it's important that I say that because many organizations are being attacked for some of their activities. Okay. So I work with Muslim organizations, for example, who have been attacked. So this organization, which Psy Noir, we are no longer called Psy Noir, we're trying to camouflage. So we have another name, yes. And the work that we do is to support people of various origins, mostly descendants from the former colonies or immigrants who are living in France, who find that they don't have a place to be heard for their grievances, who are being minimalized for their not listened to with as much empathy and compassion as they might require, because we live in a country that's quote-unquote post-racial, which of course is nonsense. I mean, we know this, we don't have the research to prove it, but we have more than enough incidents to show that that's the case. So so that's the other part of my work as a minute.
I have one more. I'm not sure if it's just a question, but so we have been, because this is also what is kind of important for us as the initiative, is we'll kind of keep going beyond these boundaries of art. And what we have been talking about today is that there's this, well, intersectionality, we could say maybe, but also this very fluid situation between what is art, what is therapy, what are the limits of art? Can we even say that there are limits? So maybe we should just think about it as some kind of limitless activity. I don't know, my question probably is that if you have thought about it at all, because again, you are a professional artist, you exhibited in Venice Biennial, so you are quite successful, and then you are very close to your mother, and art therapy was so important for you. Yes.
Yes.
That was just the end of the question.
Well, yeah, maybe I talk about another aspect. I wrote a text and I did a lecture performance which is called Art as Object Species. And so if we can imagine art as something that has been walking with humans for a very long time, coming out of nature, which is an important aspect, because then art is an individual creature. It's not something that we make, but it's something that we actually have conversation with. And an art, you know, from a colonial kind of aspect, like thinking that we are in control of something, that we are making art, that, you know, we take something and we change it into an artwork. It's kind of like this, like a mono, like that's the viewpoint of, you know, Homo sapiens somehow looking at art. But I mean, it's obvious that if we had not been in conversation with the creature of art now already for like thousands of years, we wouldn't be who we are today, you know. Like, we have created art and art has created us. And I mean, that is something that, I mean, animals also make art. You know, they build nests and there's a decorative element in nature. It wouldn't exist if it wouldn't be kind of a practical use for all the colors and the feathers of birds and all of these things. And we wouldn't see in color unless it had a reason. And so this idea about art as a species, you know, comes that if it was like a natural phenomenon, then when humans started to kind of to make art objects in an organized way, as many other animals also do, and debatable almost everything is that actually in nature itself, as it organizes itself into all kinds of things, even just the formation of a rock is an organization of atoms and things like that that actually creates something. When we talk about art history, it's kind of describing the evolution of art as a non-human species. And that has had a lot of influence on how we have developed. Like, so it's kind of to comment on like the interreaction between all the elements and many species, you know, with a little bit like the theory of Gaia by Lynn Margulis and what was his name again? Yeah, exactly. Yeah, so the healing aspects of art art is kind of this deep phenomenon, you know, that has been creating who we are and is somehow part of us and is working with us all the time.
I don't know if Augusta wants to talk to this.
No, I don't think I might.
Nature and art are creating us. I think this is maybe what art therapists are exploring, is to what extent can we help to reinforce subjectivity or individuality through the fact that they're relating to this media, like building worlds within worlds. And I was actually looking for something. Misha Foucault talks about heterotopias. And heterotopias are these, they're not utopias where everything is good, they're not dystopias where everything is bad. They're these places that seem to be imbrications, where you have elements of the real and elements that don't exist, like the imaginary, and at the same time, they do exist, in a way, for a person. So maybe that's what's happening when someone is practicing art therapy, they're building something within themselves. It's not that they're expressing so much something that's already there. Maybe they're building something that has not yet, that does not yet exist. And this discovery of their own agency is empowering.
Just going back to what you said in the beginning of your introduction about the neurodiversity today, working with plasticity, we know that for the brain, imagining something or really experiencing something can have exactly the same signals for the body, for the memory, and we know like it can be something completely imaginary and something that is completely real. So I think it also comes into that what you were just describing as something that is creating you as a human species basically, and something that is again a play between what you see or what is real or what we pretend to be to accord to the real and what is the imaginary, which has a total effect, the same effect basically. Yes.
I think Nina has a question in the back.
So we have been speaking a lot about healing and about all these positive aspects and how you a solution and so on. But of course, the question of healing also is the other side of it, which is the initial suffering. And so I wondered how you deal with, because you're working, of course, with other people who are suffering, and I wondered how you deal with that for you.
For us ourselves.
Yeah.
Hello? Is it? Hello? On.
Is it on? No, okay. I have made a lot of art that was a lot in the head, I think, also, but it is kind of healing when you're doing something that you're excited about, I think. In my imaginary worlds where I'm playing a lot, it's also very healing. And as you were saying, and also just making something is empowering. And in my music making, I make a lot of music. I see myself mostly as kind of like a hobby musician to make music at night and recording, because it's kind of it's healing to be in it and making it. You went to art therapy many years. You want to say something? Maybe.
I'm so
very quiet. I'm not sure I understood what you meant.
How you deal with pain in your? Have you dealt with pain in your life?
Yeah.
Also, maybe with pain of the children, for instance, or of the people you're working with, which is more for Tamara.
That would be for Tamara.
Yeah. I can just.
I think so.
I can just tell about my own pain that I was not able to acknowledge. I had no pain or nothing, as you remember, when I started that therapy. But when my defenses loosened, then I started to acknowledge that I had not a pain, I had not a rage. And then I started to work on it in the afternoon. Okay.
If I'm not mistaken, I think I hear two questions. The one question was, how do we work with the suffering of the people we see? And the other question that I think I heard was, how do I deal with their suffering? Yes?
Yeah.
So I can answer both questions in my own way. The suffering of the people who come to see me, or who I have the privilege to see, one of the things that I like to focus a lot on the healthy parts, which doesn't mean that I'm not taking notice of the suffering. It just means that my suggestion is to imagine the suffering. If you focus on the suffering, then it's like it's all encompassing. It's like you have a glass of water, and all you have is the suffering. But I think that the art making allows them to have the same suffering, but to see it not as a glass of water, but a drop in a pot. So it's like there's more space around the suffering. That's how I that's my approach. That's how I position myself when working with people. And for all therapists, of course, we have supervision. If you're an art therapist, you're also making art. You're constantly, you have to work with who you are and where you are and what you're dealing with, and that's what all of those other spaces are for. They're there to help, to support you while you're working with. Never go to see a therapist if the therapist is not in supervision. That's dangerous.
There is a question.
Thank you. Yeah, Erkan, I'd like to query you a little bit about your relationship to trolls. I really thank you for rehabilitating the trolls, which have kind of a bad reputation in today's society, but like in Scandinavian culture, they have a very important link to nature in an almost psychoanalytic sense, in the way that we kind of the behavior that we want to separate from civilized society, we put on the trolls. If a child is acting up, we say that he or she was switched by a troll family. And also even things like natural world, you talked about stones earlier, and as we know as Scandinavians, it's trolls that were exposed to the sun to turn into stone. So it's something for me which trolls, and also like etymological, which is linked to magic, and transformation. So for me, it's something very close between these therapeutic and pedagogical practices and the notion of the troll, because it means that we can interact with the world in a meaningful and transformative way.
The subject of the trolls must be so old, right? And it's been in the Nordic cultures, and We did research in my studio, also leading up to the Venice Biennale, to kind of understand a little bit more what I was working with, and it exists in so many, many cultures, and it means so many things, and is connected with nature. And it was funny when I was working, preparing this work for the Biennale, and I started to see the people that are in the live on the streets differently. Or it was, for sometimes it was like I was being shown something, actually. And these people that have withdrawn themselves from society, they're not able to function amongst other people, as we know that it's very often because they are traumatized, or they're just not able to kind of to function with other ones. They haven't been able to hold a job, they drive everyone away from them, and can't handle something that is inside of them and in their relationship with the environment and society. And I guess that when trolls were being drawn like a few hundred years ago in Scandinavia, etc., probably the images that people that they were something that inspired the artists that were drawing these figures, and they might have been these people that withdrew themselves and that often have crazy hair or even long nails and only look out with one eye. And I mean, I saw real trolls in the streets of Berlin, you know, for a few years, and then I remember, and one day I had a very strong experience. I was outside of my studio, and a young woman comes and she sits beside me and just is like kind of asking for help. She had came from, I don't remember which country, out of Syria maybe, and she was mega traumatized. She just thought that she was gonna die or something, and it was right in the middle of this whole thing. And the many of the Icelandic trolls were people that literally something happened in society and they withdrew themselves and went to the mountains, and maybe these people were living in the mountains and were scary to the other people, and maybe they survived for a little time and then probably they died, and some of them became mythological because they were associated with a whole mountain or something. And sometimes people started to, when they were sailing on ships, they started to bet on them that I would give this if this troll or like a ghost or something would protect us. The element of the troll is very large, and I think I'm just tapping into an idea that belongs to human society and belongs in many societies. I was in Greece recently. Is somebody Greek here? I think the word for crazy in Greek is trillo or something like that, which I found really interesting because I found it very close to the word troll. And nowadays it's Greek. It's a very big subject. I approached it in a very kind of a playful way, actually. I was I actually just saw some troll in a tourist store, and I thought it was the kind of most hilarious things, and something that an artist should absolutely not work with, you know, like if an American artist would make art piece about the Statue of Liberty or something, like the worst thing that you can work with. So I started fooling around with it for many, many years before I then it developed a lot, actually, in a conversation with a Chilean artist friend of mine, Diego Fernandez. We were just playing trolls in my studio for many months, and we were making all kinds of things. I was always hiding them away because I found it so silly. But then I saw an exhibition, a big overview exhibition of the works of Tove Jansson, who is the author of the Moomin Trolls. And I saw that the way that she created this universe was much more than just like children books. I thought, like, I see, because I think that sometimes when if you paint a painting, it's like often, like before abstract painting, it was like a world somewhere else, so you created a world. And I thought that the Moomin universe was just like that. It was like a living painting where everything could happen, and I thought that she should be seen as an artist, not as a children book writer, but as a serious artist, you know. So I said, God damn it, I got to bring my trolls out. So I decided to bring them out. But it started as like the foolish joke, you know.
So I think we can slowly finish because we have also some drinks and some quiche and some snacks. So we can continue also after that. So Tamara, would you like? Is it the moment to speak about the exercise downstairs? Or yeah,
if anyone would like,
because we actually gather some of them.
Yes, you gather thank you for participating in this little exercise. I would like to know if you consent to them being passed out so that someone else can read or show your work. Is that okay? Yes?
Yeah.
Does anyone not want that to happen? Okay, so I will hand them out, and maybe whoever you get, you can read or show what is on the card. Yeah? We wanted to know what your thoughts were about art and healing. And maybe after we've shared this, you would like to make another card, and you can make a painting, or not painting, a drawing, or write a word or a phrase about what your thoughts are now about art and healing, as maybe something has changed.
Hello. So this one is in French. Quand j'entends les mots art et healing, j'ai l'impression que l'art peut être le meilleur moyen pour créer, si je ne me trompe pas, un état de bien-être. Le meilleur moyen pour créer un état de bien-être. Is it okay in translation?
To try to translate.
So, if I hear the words art and healing, I have the impression that art could be the best way to create a state of well-being.
Moi, j'ai une réaction français horrible, parce que c'est en anglais que je suis utilisée en anglais. I think about trust, about true responsibility of holding through listening and vulnerability when I think of art and healing.
Donc,
je vais essayer. Alors, je crois en la confiance et en la responsabilité vraie de. Alors là, of holding through. Du soin au travers de l'écoute et de la vulnérabilité quand je pense à l'art et à la guérison.
Mine says art mediation and health, and it's written like mediation as a link between art and health. Mine says art is healing, so the person added the verb in between art and healing, and I would reply that art is a verb, and verbs move things in different directions, one of them being healing, which is really beautiful. Thank you.
May I say something? I don't have the paper, but my work is a little bit around this. I'm working on what is the madness of holiness today. And I'm under depression and anxiety, so I know those processes, and I'm artist. I've started to paint and write since age of 6. And it's very beautiful that you help in this way, and I'm sure that it helps. But it's look like here that art can do everything and can really heal completely, because I can bring to you artists that they done all the life they are, that they couldn't live, like Schumann or others, that they spend all the life to art, and they or Edvard Munch, they, I mean, of course art can heal in a way, but it seems like it does all the miracles, and it's so complex, the human being is so complex, and it has to handle in a lot of things, and sometimes art is not it's not enough. Even for me, it's not enough. I mean, if it was enough for me with writing, and also I didn't write in my mother tongue language, because if not, I'm going to be burned, because all Albania is going to grow up. And I needed a language. It was completely interest for my childhood. And everyone asked to me, so Ornella, how about you, all your, how to say, wounds get a little bit, or how to say, healed or helped because you're old. For my case, it didn't. I'm still dealing with them, and I think, because now a little bit the question, we never know ourselves, but a little bit some limits I know, and I'm going to die with this. But I went all my life through this. I know at Santan they have done with sick people, schizophrenic, a lot of works with drawing, art. But I mean, it was wonderful. If it was so absolute, the art heals and art heals. So it's...
The title says, art can heal.
Yes, it can heal. But I mean, yeah, there are a lot of artists that have done life. And so
I think the Tamara is the best to answer to this.
No, but I'm happy that you're saying this, because this is precisely the discussion that we had when I said, well, art can really heal. And I said, not people who commit suicide.
Of course, how many artists?
So there's a limit to what you can do.
Yes.
And it can have an impact on how you experience the suffering. And it's going to be singular and different, and the pathways are always singular and different for everyone. And so we don't know quite how it works for some people and how it doesn't work for some people.
Of course, there are states of people, a person is in a state that even it's not interesting to do and exercise.
But thank you for saying what you've said. Then the question has to become something like, I don't know if anyone here, from what I heard, was so categoric to say, art is the way. But this is...
It seems from the what I read, yeah, art becomes healing, art heals, art... Yeah, of course, it helps. But, if I lost the beginning of this meeting with Ken, yes, of course I was going, but... Yeah, it's very, very much relative, because knowing also the lives of... There are a lot of commissaires, curators that have worked with genius and melancholia, folie en Occident, and artists, so they are very, very related, and yes, of course, it helps, but...
It can change someone's relationship to suffering. It doesn't necessarily mean suffering.
That's how I want it, just to...
No, thank you very much. It was quite clear from what everyone was saying today.
Okay.
Yeah. But I agree, it can also make your life even darker. You know,
yeah. Absolutely, it can be a demon for me now, right now. Art is a demon,
yeah.
The passion can turn into a demon.
Yeah.
And I have to deal with it. It was a passion in the beginning, and then after it divorced me. And yes.
Art can destroy it.
Absolutely, in a lot of cases we have Schumann, we have, I don't know, you can see the anxiety in paintings of Bosch or of Munch or Bacon, and I think they died depressed.
I'm trying to make it fast.
It can heal, but I know that from what I'm doing today, it's grace of the hell I lived. So it is this also what comment s'appelle mon chantier, the source. So I'm working with it comes from this
of being, I don't know, melancholic or sad or depressed. I work with this, yeah. So it's bilateral. It can help, but you also can have from this material to, yes, to do, I don't know, something else.
That's why it's like a spectrum. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Spectrum. How does it work? We don't know how.
No, no, we don't know anything. So I mean, we don't know. We're just on
vamos
a tono.
Then that will be also a different discussion. So it will be like a different discussion of relationship between who are starting with a certain setup, especially working with children, with a kind of making, let's say, the life easier, getting out of certain, let's say, trauma.
It's beautiful. It's beautiful. But
of course, nobody was saying that it can solve the problems and also all the psychological state.
Yes, so maybe this is not helping in the discussion because this says healing means express trauma, share it, and get it out of one system. So maybe this is fine for the discussion. But first it says art is taking care of the world, is taking care of oneself, and is taking care of the others.
Okay. Collective conscious knowledge, accepting and dealing better with the idea of mistakes.
Forgetting was not the same as healing in the deep by Rivers Salomon. And then there is a nice drawing I'm going to show to you. Which is art equal memory equal feelings, and then it leads to history, and then it equals healing. The senses can express what words sometimes cannot.
Mine is a drawing of a sun hugging a tree. That's also a woman. Yes.
Find one, and it's art is everything for me. Photography is an art form. Shortly, beauty of life is art for me.
Art is a diagram that connects different words in French. Little drawings with it. Maybe I'll read a few ones. Soigner et cicatrices. Cicatriser avec de la pommade. Des plantes, de l'amour, de la considération, de l'art, se trouver, se multiplier, se rencontrer collectivement, soi-même, avec des inconnus, avec des proches. Mes mains sont mon cœur, mes mains sont mes corazons.